Why do leaves change their color? We're exploring the science of the gorgeous fall color and appreciating the season's beauty on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin fall color map shows that peak season is furthest along in Douglas and Florence counties in the northernmost reaches of our state. The notes from Florence County say that the fall colorama is definitely in full swing. Do you know why those trees get the blazing reds and yellows? Are you more into the bronzes and auburns of fall color? What are you seeing where you are? It's 800-642-1234. Heather Schenck is a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at UW La Crosse. Heather, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning. We also have Tim Gerber here, a UW La Crosse biology professor. Tim, welcome to you.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. Well, let's start with you, Tim, with changing leaves. That always seems like a tale of two Wisconsins with, you know, the northern parts of the state much further along than the south. Is that holding true this year?
Yeah, it generally works that way, and it is that way this year, too. There are a lot of variables in it, but that part is pretty consistent.
Yeah. So what are you seeing now with the changing colors?
We're at in La Crosse. We're right around about 25% color.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's always looking for peak. So obviously, if you go further north, as mentioned, the northern part of Wisconsin, definitely farther along. And I've traveled kind of up and down the northern or up to the northern part of the state. And things started changing a little bit earlier this year, which was, I guess, nice for the people who are out early. But if you travel to different parts of the state, there are a number of variables that affect kind of those colors that you see. I mean, even within a county.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, we're going to look at some of those variables. So, Heather, drum roll, why do leaves change color?
You know, it's a very good question. We might start by asking, why are they colored at all? Because that'll help us understand why those colors change. The color that we see in a leaf is from some small structures. If we really zoomed in to the inside of the leaf, we would find pigments, so colored molecules, that are they're connections of atoms that are found, you know, it's this repeating pattern of connections that's found across many, many plants, which is why we see the same green color. But the green is only one of the pigments that a plant makes. And why does it make them at all?
Yeah.
These pigments are used by the plant for this ingenious process called photosynthesis, where a plant has figured out how to take energy from the sun, light energy, and turn it into chemical energy. So it can harness sunlight to drive the processes that the plant needs to do in order to survive. So we're seeing, with those colors, we're seeing plants soaking up sunlight. And the reason the colors change is because that green, that's the main light harvesting pigment that plants use. But in the fall, when our trees realize there's less light, you know, the days are getting shorter and the nights are getting colder, our trees decide to go dormant and they say, I'm not going to harvest light in the winter. There won't be enough of it. So they stop making this green molecule that's called chlorophyll. And that chlorophyll starts to break down and be swept away inside the leaf structure. And then we can see popping out the other colors from other pigments that are in the leaves, but they're overpowered by the green of chlorophyll during the summer. Those other colors also have some light harvesting roles, but they're also in some ways like a sunscreen for the leaf, because they're protecting that plant from dangerous levels of radiation or kind of an overdose of sunshine. That's kind of why I would call it sunscreen. And those are different colors from the chlorophyll, the green of the chlorophyll. So we can see yellows and oranges. That's a type of structure that's often called a carotenoid because the first type was isolated from carrot. You might be able to hear the word carrot hiding in carotenoid. And there's also another type that doesn't resemble any word that we've met. That those are the anthocyanins, and those tend to more the reds and the purples and blues.
And isn't the beta-carotene that gives that orange hue?
Yes, exactly. We see beta-carotene in many of our foods, many yellow and orange vegetables and fruits. Also, egg yolk is yellow because of carotene.
Then there are the flavanols that are always present in leaves. What do the flavonoid family do?
You know, those I tend to think of having less color, but I think I'm going to throw this question over to Tim because he knows more about what happens inside the leaf.
Tim, you go ahead.
Sure. Well, in terms of protection of the leaf, yes, but the leaves have to make these sugars for actually the entire plant. So that's what the chlorophyll is there for, and you've got these other things going on inside of that, or these other chemicals going on inside of that leaf that equally are important. Oftentimes we forget why, you know, these carotenes and other things are there. They help protect, I guess, the machinery on the inside of the plants too. So UV radiation, etc., is dangerous to, or will break down all kinds of molecules. So it's kind of dangerous to the plant, just like it affects us, it affects them too. So the all those flavanols, all the anthocyanins, etc., are a good screen, and they're important equally. It's just the chlorophylls are dominant.
Sure, yeah. I'm going to just reintroduce you. We're learning about why leaves change color, and we have UW La Crosse professors Tim Gerber and Heather Shank. Heather specializes in chemistry. Tim teaches biology. You can join in with what you want to ask about the changing color and the chemistry of what goes on in leaves. 800-642-1234. Josh is joining us from Oak Creek. Hi, Josh.
Hi, guys. I have a question. I absolutely love the fall colors, but I've often wondered, so with what you guys were just saying about the chemistry and the breakdown of the chlorophyll, the leaves changing color, and of course they all fall off the trees, when that process happens, does that, and being that trees and leaves and all that clean our atmosphere, is it safe to say that our air quality actually goes down through the winter then?
Tim, Heather, who wants to tackle this?
Well, I will add that, so if you look at carbon dioxide is, of course, in the news. So carbon dioxide goes up and down in the, or the concentrations of it go up and down in the atmosphere. All right. So when you have lots of leaves, as you're describing, all right, there's all kinds of carbon dioxide being pulled out of the atmosphere. When at least the deciduous trees lose their leaves at the end of the growing season, carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere will go up because there aren't as many leaves pulling the carbon out of the atmosphere. So pollution and things like that. So just pollution is a broad variety of different things. We'll just focus on carbon dioxide for right now. The carbon dioxide goes; it fluctuates. In fact, you can see these on graphs if you look across the seasons from year to year to year. So, obviously, carbon dioxide is affected. So are other things that the plant will take into it, or other gases and things like that that the plants will exchange and use. So, a lot of people are or have been interested in, like even NASA over the years, about how plants can actually clean the air. So, clean in kind of quotes, whatever that means. So, the pollution part of it is yes, the leaves will pull all kinds of gases out of the atmosphere, and it will make it, if you want to think of it cleaner in that regard. I'm just focusing on one gas like carbon dioxide because it's been highly studied, right? But there's been a lot of work that's done on other pollutants and how plants can pull like different gases out of the atmosphere.
Let's pause here with Tim Gerber and Heather Schenck at UW La Crosse. They teach biology and chemistry, respectively. What do you want to know about the changing fall colors through the lens of the hard sciences? What have you always wondered about that favorite tree you admire each day? When and why its leaves change color and drop to the ground? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're exploring why autumn leaves change their color and the chemical processes going on as trees get ready for a long winter. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Minnesota DNR told Minneapolis St. Paul magazine that changing leaves will be a bit different this year as a result of drought. They said stressed trees are ditching leaves early, may fall just short of our fall color expectations. Are trees changing near you? Are you noticing duller hues? Join in 800-642-1234. Heather Schenck and Tim Gerber are professors at UW La Crosse teaching chemistry and biology. So, Heather, what does extreme temperatures or drought do to trees, and how does that affect autumn color?
Well, in general terms, just as we would be stressed in a high temperature situation, especially, you know, for example, for thinking of our own systems, if things don't cool down at night, for example, we might feel some heat stress. Trees and plants can as well, and they're just the chemical processes that need to happen in the plant just may not happen as well in drought. You know, it simply does not have the water it needs in order to conduct, you know, the normal chemistry of the plant. So if that lasts for long enough, then the tree is going to have to, or whatever plant you're looking at, is going to have to kind of pull back its resources a little bit. Tim, what would you add?
Well, if you think of a plant as like a big straw that's stuck in the ground, pulling water out of that ground, if it's really dry, there's very little water in the soil, then there's not a lot of water to pull up through that plant, and the plant is stressed. That's absolutely right. So if you have all that water stress and you don't have enough, all right, it definitely affects the health. We'll just use a general term. It affects the health of the plant, just like it would affect your health, too, if you didn't have enough water. The cooling process, actually, so the plants will pull water in through their roots. It'll go up through their stems into their leaves, but it exits the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And when it exits the leaf, it helps cool the plant. That's what she's referring to. So as that cooling process occurs, right, it helps keep plant temperatures regulated also. So high heat, you really stress them out. You have plenty of water and you have a healthy plant, they're much less stressed, and they can perform naturally or perform normally. This is a better term.
I think that leads into asking, you know, what causes that leaf to die and fall to the ground each year, Tim?
Sure. The plants can tell time. So as the days get shorter and the nights get longer, it's a chemical process and a molecular process and a hormonal process. They understand that, okay, you know, the days are getting shorter, the nights are getting longer, and we're going to start losing our leaves. So the plants actually produce a little corky material between where the leaf attaches to the stem of the tree. And that corky material kind of seals that connection between the stem and the leaf. It seals it off. So when the leaf starts, it no longer has a connection. It doesn't have the fluids. It doesn't have the water and minerals and things like that. It actually will die and fall off. But the tree is protected because it's got that little corky layer in there. So, you know, water won't start just leaking out of the tree either. So it's a interesting process. The plant leaves on the trees, on the deciduous trees, they'll just senesce.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just die off. So it knows it's getting the nights are getting longer and the days are getting shorter, it's time to produce that seal, and then the leaf falls off. Those are for deciduous trees, the trees that lose their leaves at the end of the growing season.
I just love thinking that leaves or that trees can tell time. You know, Heather, my kids have always asked, you know, what do bare trees do during the winter? And I've always just told them, well, you know, they rest. Is there a better answer?
You know, I think Tim's term, senesce. Technically, it's a rest. Right? Mm-hmm. So we may not always notice when trees are starting to wake up in the spring. We see buds pop and we say, oh, look, the tree is waking up. But if you're watching carefully in those early months, probably the late months of winter, you may see bark change color on the dogwoods, and you might see buds swelling before they pop. So those trees are waking up. That's why the maple syrup makers get out in February and they're tapping those trees, because the trees are starting to circulate fluids more than they did in the winter, and that's the best time to collect your sap for maple syrup.
If you're just joining us, we're learning more about when and why the leaves change color in Wisconsin, and we have chemistry professor Heather Schenck, and we have a biology professor, Tim Gerber. We have a question here. Mike from Slinger called, couldn't stay with us. Mike says they're driving down to Florida at the end of October and is wondering, will they see the fall colors as they drive from north to south? What might that look like, Tim?
Well, part of the color is dependent on the different species of trees, the different kinds of trees. So we have very different color types. We live in La Crosse. So if you look at the trees along the river, the floodplain, we call it floodplain forest, they have a very different look than the trees maybe up in the hills, just because they're different species. So you're driving down through the United States. It depends on what you change the different kinds of species that you find. You get down to Florida, and I'm not as familiar with Florida, have lived down there. The colors, when they change, there's a lot of golden colors. I don't remember, though, as nearly as many like reds and oranges and things like that you would see up here.
Yeah.
So I think the Florida trees are going to be, I think they'll be more golden in color. But they certainly have deciduous trees down there, and they certainly lose their leaves at the end of the growing season. So they have a color change, but it's not quite as dramatic as it is up north here.
Yeah, and you know, when I think of fall color, oftentimes New England comes to mind. Why is New England so beautiful with autumn foliage?
Well, it comes back to that, the different species again.
Okay.
So we're fortunate in Wisconsin, Minnesota, just kind of across the northern tier into New England. We've got lots of maples and things like that, and maples are, well, our Wisconsin state tree is sugar maple, so sugar maple is, it just shows you all those different colors, and they've got lots of maples out east too.
Yeah.
So it is, and oaks and things like that. So it is a lot of what the species composition is, the different types of trees that you have definitely affect the colors that you'll see. And we see that here in Wisconsin, certainly in Minnesota.
Something that's really special about this cycle as well, Heather, is that, you know, when the leaves fall, they're recycled. They're decomposing to make richer soil. And I just think how Mother Nature doesn't waste anything, and maybe we should learn more from her playbook. What do you make of that decomposition and the whole cycle of the leaves?
Oh, I love it. I leverage it. I will be honest with you. I will not put my leaves out to the curb. I put them in my compost. Because all summer, all year, I'm putting into my compost what you might call green waste. You know, I'm putting in trimmings off of celery and things like that. But for a good compost, you want to have a mixture of green and brown materials. I use the brown autumn leaves, and I just put them right in my compost heap. And boy, do I have a lot of mulch in the spring.
Oh, that's so great. I love it. How about you, Tim? What do you think of the decomposition of leaves and what they offer us?
Sure. Well, from a biological standpoint, just imagine the forest if we didn't have bacteria and fungi and organisms that decompose. The leaves would accumulate. They wouldn't break down. Why would they? We'd be buried in leaves. So part of that process is as the leaves die, these bacteria and fungi and mildews and all these other organisms, they're breaking on those materials and producing, as Heather said, the compost basically for the forest. Mm. So you're converting that into kind of that upper layer of real dark material that you see that is organic material. Well, and that's a feeder. It's the nutrients that the plants will use again. So it's the circle of life, right?
Oh, the circle of life. Heather and Tim, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was a
thank
pleasure.
Thank you.
Heather Schenck, professor of chemistry at UW-La Crosse. Tim Gerber, UW-La Crosse biology professor. News is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about the origins of a regional name for a chicken barbecue.
As part of Wisconsin Public Radio's Wisconsin project, we received a question from Mary Lee, who grew up near La Crosse. She asked, what is the origin of the chicken queue? Well, chicken queue is a name for a charcoal-grilled chicken dinner sold as part of a fundraiser, but the name is only known regionally in the La Crosse area. Andrea Anderson has more on the mystery of the chicken queue.
So on the count of three. One, two, three.
It's a hazy summer day at a busy intersection in La Crosse. Brewster Andy's Catering is preparing charcoal-grilled half-chicken dinners, complete with beans, potato salad, and a roll. Today's proceeds benefit a school's basketball program. Dan Parisi of La Crosse waits in line for his order. He frequents chicken queues a couple times a month. He likes the convenience of not having to cook and the taste of grilled chicken, but the name chicken queue escapes him.
I just assume barbecued chicken. I don't know. I have no idea where it came up. I have no clue.
Even the professionals aren't sure. Three catering companies run chicken queue events in the La Crosse area, and they just have theories about where the name chicken queue comes from. Rooster Andy's grill master, Andy Faulkner, says if you drive much outside of La Crosse, no one has even heard of the chicken queue.
Not really. Even as close as Rochester, most people just aren't aware what a chicken queue is.
On one side, three pits at a time. I go down the other side and somebody threw a match in. Boom, boom, boom.
In the basement of Holy Trinity Catholic Church in La Crosse, people who've put on their own chicken queues for decades sit around and tell old war stories. Gene Jursa organized the church's first chicken queue back in 1970. His theory of how the name came to be is as solid as anyone's.
D.R. Schultz was a beer distributor, and he had his employees that would work these chicken queues when they started getting into them.
E.R. Schultz, or Elmer, was a beer distributor in La Crosse after Prohibition. Newspaper ads from the 1930s and 40s say he stocked brands like Blatt's and Kingsbury. A Facebook post on a La Crosse history page says E.R.'s brother, Art, ran Acadia Friars in Trempealeau County, just north of La Crosse. Acadia Friars was the longtime name of a chicken farmers cooperative started in the 1920s that still exists today under the name Pilgrims. Jursa says Holy Trinity used to get the chicken it served from E.R. Schultz.
We got all the chicken from Acadia Friars. Acadia had all the chicken.
The concept of a chicken dinner fundraiser is not unique to La Crosse. But the name Chicken Queue is. There are thousands of references to chicken queues in old files from the La Crosse Tribune, but no accounts explaining where or how the name started. In the 1970s, Holy Trinity Catholic Church used to sell more than 3,000 chicken dinners twice a year to benefit the church and the Boy Scouts. While the church still does 2 fundraisers each year, they are about half in sales of what they once were. Ron Fitzpatrick took over from Gene Gersa as organizer.
It's very hard to get people to volunteer. When Gene was involved and I first got involved in it, people were here from 5 in the morning till 7 o'clock at night. Now you have people that'll come for a couple hours here and a couple hours there, and I take whatever I can get.
Chicken queues remain popular with some nonprofits still organizing them. A cottage industry started in the 1980s with professional caterers now arranging chicken queues with proceeds going to nonprofits.
Andrea Anderson brought us that story on the chicken queues of La Crosse. This story was produced by John Davis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
And now to Germany and how the country has handled testing for COVID. Europe as a continent has pushed ahead of the U.S. in vaccinating its people. According to the University of Oxford's Our World in Data project, the European Union had a comparatively subdued summer of COVID caseloads, hospitalizations, and deaths. Have you visited Germany or another country during the pandemic? How do you compare their approach to fighting the pandemic with the U.S.? It's 800-642-1234. Stephanie Friedhoff is a German-American journalist who has specialized in pandemic response research and policy and crisis communications. She's a professor of practice at Brown University School of Public Health. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So you visited Germany for a few weeks over the summer. What were some of the contrasts that you could draw in how the U.S. has responded versus what you saw in Germany?
Yeah, it was quite striking. You know, as soon as we got off the plane in Hamburg Airport, there was a first testing booth for anybody who needed a quick rapid test before they would go on a flight to go to some other place in Europe. And it continued through our trip. I was really struck by how testing is available everywhere for free for anybody who lives in the country. There's a popular pool we take the kids to every year. And sure enough, in the parking lot D, there was a testing tent. So you could test the kids, you know, before you go in the pool and then be okay.
What about in terms of going to other public places like restaurants, or what did you see around schools? I know it's summer there, but what did you see around other public places?
Yeah, it was the same everywhere, that you have a couple of restaurants and there's testing available. People do mask around, you know, there's other mitigation measures such as masking, and you have reduced numbers, but not by much. Life was really going on as usual because there was, you know, ubiquitous testing. And schools specifically, the testing is so helpful because you can identify, you know, where the virus spreads, who is already infected and not. And it was quite striking how everybody was participating also in these measures.
How did you show your proof of vaccination? What was that like?
Ooh, we had fun with our little CDC cards. everybody had their proof of vaccination on an app on the phone. Even my 86-year-old in-laws did. But not everybody, you know, had been eligible to be vaccinated when we were there. So the country had invested in testing and other measures to keep people safe.
Did you and your family get tested while in Germany at these rapid test sites?
Yes, we did. We did get tested. We also, you know, for 95 cents, you can buy a test in any store. So we also did home testing. We were really hoping to keep our friends and family safe. We traveled from state to state. You know, we went out and about a lot. And obviously in a pandemic, that's not what you usually do, unless you can, you know, make sure it's highly likely that you're not infectious. So we use these tests really to be free and see family after 2 years of being away.
That sounds like a very modest amount. You can buy a rapid test in drugstores for about a dollar. Who is paying for all these tests?
Yeah, the German government is. The government really decided early that we needed these tests for the public good, and made sure that there was the right incentives for the makers of industry to produce those tests and distribute them. It invested in healthcare workers and lab technicians who could administer the tests, and then make the free tests available really to anybody. I have a friend who has a very sick husband, and she was super isolated all last year. And this year she could use those tests to just test anybody who comes to her house. It's 15 minutes. You wait a moment outside, and then you're ready to go in and see each other.
What was the cost of your testing before you went to Germany in order, to get on that plane?
Oh, dear. We paid $500 for four rapid tests for my husband, I, and our two children, because we live in Massachusetts, so free testing technically is available, but in order to get an appointment, we had to wait much longer than we could. The airline had just tested the requirements for vaccinated people to be tested. So, and we all know it's a mad scramble right now to get a test, especially for travel reasons if you don't have symptoms.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Stephanie Friedhoff, who's a professor at Brown University School of Public Health, and she's talking to us about her recent trip to Germany and how Germany is handling the pandemic compared to the U.S. Let's go to Karen in Madison. Hi, Karen. What is your experience?
Well, I'm actually working at the World Dairy Expo that's happening in Madison right now, and a lot of the European exhibitors weren't actually able to come to the U.S. I was told by one of our German exhibitors that while they were able to get their visas within a few days, colleagues from Scandinavia and France weren't able to get permission to come. And then also at the expo, anyone at the expo can get a free COVID test, through Friday from 10 to 12. So that if they need to get back to their country with tests, they can get that done. It's the same as the rest of the Dane County testing program. And I believe we've also got vaccinations available, but don't quote me on that. Although I guess we're on the radio. So
Karen, what is turnout like at the Wisconsin Dairy Expo? Approximately how many people?
I don't have numbers, but usually we would be... for international guests, usually by the end of the show, it's a one-week show, we would have 2,500 to 3,000, and we had just over 100 registered yesterday.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah, our international attendees are really down. Mostly they're coming in from Latin America. Almost nobody from Europe, some from Africa, and some from the Indian subcontinent.
Yeah.
But otherwise, yeah, very curtailed.
Karen, thank you for sharing this. Stephanie, almost no one from Europe at the huge Wisconsin Dairy Expo. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it is very sad, right? It is a failure of public health in the United States. We have such high surges across the country because we're not using testing, right? In many places, we're not using some of the easy to do mitigation measures, and because of that the economy suffers, and the United States right now is considered a high risk country in Europe. We were lucky to make it back in time to make it there, it's just we could do better.
We're talking with Brown University School of Public Health professor Stephanie Friedhoff, sharing her experiences in Germany and how one of Europe's largest countries is handling the pandemic. Have you been tested before or been on a regular COVID testing schedule? How was that experience and the effect on your daily routine? Do you think schools and employers should test people for the virus more frequently? How much is enough? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Stephanie Friedhoff here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're discussing Germany's response to testing in the pandemic and experiences of a public health professor who visited recently. Germany's health minister announced in recent days that the government will stop paying compensation to unvaccinated workers who are forced into quarantine, telling Reuters that it's unfair to ask taxpayers to subsidize people who refuse to get the COVID vaccine. Have you followed another country's COVID protocols like Germany? What policies elsewhere in the world should the U.S. emulate? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Stephanie Friedhoff focuses on pandemic response research at Brown University's School of Public Health and stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Stephanie, I want to talk a little bit further about this friend whose husband has Parkinson's disease, and how has testing changed their lives?
Well, when you have Parkinson's disease, right, you're very vulnerable. COVID and COVID infection, very likely you will not survive, certainly not the stage that he is in. And that has meant for his wife, who is his caretaker at home and is trying to prevent him from having to be, you know, permanently in an institution, that she has been very isolated. She couldn't see friends. And by having these tests available, you can easily educate. The tests are so easy to use. My kids use them, you know, after the third one, they knew how to use them pretty much by themselves. The tests will tell you if it didn't get enough specimen, right? If you didn't use it right, and then you just take another one because they literally are only 95 cents. So it has allowed my friend to see people, to have more help in the house. She only had two aides who were cleared and got an early vaccination to come in. And now she does no longer have to sort of carry the burden of being on 24/7. To take care of her husband.
Yeah, and she can put these rapid tests in the hallway outside her apartment, I understand, and visitors can take one and then just wait for the results.
Yes, indeed. That's how it works. There's a little testing station in the house. Yeah.
That seems very handy. Yes. Are German residents okay with all this testing, or has there been backlash?
Not really, not significantly. Germans don't mind. Testing hasn't been politicized the same way as testing and masking and a number of other things have in the United States. It's just something that you do to keep everybody safe. Mm-hmm. And the news you mentioned earlier about no longer paying for people who are not vaccinated, it's really important to understand that underneath that is a system, a social safety net that so far, if you have tested positive for COVID, right, you would be provided with everything you need if it is help finding a hotel room for quarantine, and that will be paid, by the way. And there's no worry about sick days. People will bring you food if you need it. So there are way fewer barriers for testing or vaccination than there are in the United States because of that social safety net. And yet politicians are now using it in order, or the authorities are using it, in order to drive more people towards getting vaccinated. But it's really important to understand that that is like an underlying current that doesn't exist for everybody in the United States.
Yeah, certainly a contrast. You know, here the pandemic has really been hyper-politicized, and the divisions over wearing masks and taking tests, getting vaccinated. Why do you think that Germany is different?
Well, as anybody who's grown up between two cultures and lived in more than two, I've thought about this question so much over the past 18 months. I do think that this the social safety net question is really important. Germany is essentially a consensus society. We try to take care of each other, and the United States is an individualist society. And I think that is a fundamental difference. The politicization, you know, the political systems are so different. There's a little bit of that going on, but not so much. Like, politicians are not harvesting the pandemic for their individual gain. And that is what we're seeing in the U.S.
We're talking with Stephanie Friedhoff, who's a professor at Brown University School of Public Health, talking about her recent trip to Germany and how the country has handled the pandemic compared to the U.S. With your experiences as well, join in at 800-642-1234. You know, of course, the German election on Sunday brought a shift in power from Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party to the left-leaning Social Democratic Party. Do you expect, Stephanie, to see a shift in the pandemic response in any way because of the shift in power?
No, I don't. Not so much, because the parties work much closer together. And because we have a multiple party system, they have been required to form coalitions in one way or another for the past 50 years. So there isn't the deep rifts between the parties that you see in the United States. And again, there is a joint belief that we can only get out of this pandemic together, mm-hmm. and that unites the country.
You know, sometimes that empirical data, the observations on street level, they contrast with the metrics that we're seeing on dashboards. And I think that might be the case with Oxford's Our World in Data project. And I was looking at it, and it shows that the U.S. is in line with other countries on testing and even slightly above Germany for testing per 1,000 people. And the U.K., it's showing, is a huge outlier, performing many more tests than the rest of the world. What do you make of the contrast between the metrics and experiences in country on the ground?
I think one key difference here is that all the individual tests that we do are not counted.
Ah,
right? So uh-huh. All the tests I buy in the store and do with my kids at home, they're not counted. So that is a key difference. And could you repeat the question?
No, that's okay. Yeah, I mean, I was just looking at, as the dashboards say one thing and your experiences really show another thing, it might be that these rapid tests are making all the difference here.
Yes, I do believe so. The rapid tests are making all the difference.
How often do you go back to Germany, or are you thinking about another trip?
Next summer, I hope. We go once a year.
Yeah, yeah. What is it like comparatively when there hasn't been a pandemic and you've gone back to Germany? Is it strikingly different?
It was strikingly different. There really has been a coming together, and now we often see in the news the negative parts of what's going on, and there are now Trump supporters and all those things, but you understand that life is precious and that you're excited to see each other. Mm-hmm. And I've been really grateful to have the chance to go this summer, in part thanks to those measures.
Stephanie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stephanie Friedhoff is a German-American journalist specializing in pandemic response research policy. She is a professor of practice at Brown University School of Public Health. Just ahead, it is a Northwestern University law professor and her new book that explores why male sexual abusers are given far more credibility than the women who come forward with assault allegations. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.